This is one of a series of tape slide talks on electroluminescence and semiconductor lasers, recorded May 11, 1966, at Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. The seminar was organized by Gerald J. Herskowitz, Carl Connerth, and Elliot Schlamm of the Basic Sciences Committee of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, New York Section. A recorded voice interspersed with the speaker will give numbers corresponding to the numbered slides accompanying this recording. Begin by projecting slide 0, the title slide, now. The second talk is State of the Art in Gallium Arsenide Lasers, presented by Dr. Marshall I. Nathan, IBM Research Laboratories, Yorktown Heights, New York. Now project slide 0A, picture of Dr. Nathan.
It is over 3.5 years since injection lasers first became a laboratory reality, and in that time they've been a subject of intensive research. As you've just seen in the previous talk, much work has been done in finding new laser materials which extend the range of wavelengths available from semiconductor lasers, and also in utilizing several different pumping schemes. I'm going to talk about gallium arsenide junction lasers, which have received the most extensive study and development of any semiconductor laser. Gallium arsenide oscillates at 8,400 angstroms at 77 degrees K, just outside the visible range of the eye. It is still the shortest wavelength PN junction single compound laser, and it is within the range of good photodetectors. Gallium arsenide phosphide alloys are shorter wavelength. They go down to 6,500 angstroms. But the fact that they are alloys limits their usefulness because of the reduced thermal conductivity.
Slide 1.
The first slide shows an energy level diagram for a degenerately doped PN junction which can be used as a laser. When a bias is applied, as in the bottom part of the slide, the electrons flow from the N side to the P side, as I've drawn it, where they can recombine and emit light. For a high enough applied voltage, there will be a region in the vicinity of the junction where the population is inverted, that is, where the conduction band is filled up to some energy with electrons and the valence band or acceptor levels are empty down to some energy, and then we can have stimulated emission.
Slide 1A.
PN junctions for lasers are most commonly made by diffusion of impurities. In gallium arsenide, an acceptor, usually zinc, is diffused into an N-type substrate with a carrier concentration in the range of from about 10 to the 17th to 10 to the 19th per cubic centimeter. The diffusion front for zinc is anomalously sharp because it diffuses interstitially. Capacitance measurements show that the net impurity concentration, acceptors minus donors, is graded near the junction, but with a fairly high gradient. Alternate methods have also been used for the preparation of lasers. For example, epitaxial solution regrowth has been used by Nelson at RCA. In this technique, a solution of gallium arsenide plus dopants dissolved in gallium or tin near its saturation temperature is allowed to flow over an oppositely doped gallium arsenide wafer. Cooling results in epitaxial growth on the wafer and a PN junction at the interface. Some of the wafer is first dissolved so that a fresh surface is at the junction. Since the growth tends to go along 100 crystallographic planes, good planar junctions can be obtained by this technique. Laser junctions have also been made by epitaxial regrowth from the vapor phase. Now, since the active region is only a few microns thick in the vicinity of the junction, the maximum gain will be in the plane of the junction. Therefore, it is desirable to make a resonant structure to take advantage of this. Now, the structure most often used is the Fabry-Perot type structure shown in the next slide.
Slide 2.
Negative slides. The reflecting ends perpendicular to the junctions are made optically flat and parallel by polishing or cleaving along 110 crystallographic planes. The other two sides are sawed or etched to eliminate the coherent feedback. because of the high index of refraction, the reflectivity of the reflecting ends is high enough so that it's not necessary to have extra reflective coatings applied. However, such coatings can be put on if it is desired. Now, it is important that good electrical contact be made over the whole top and bottom of the laser to give a uniform current distribution, since non-uniform currents will cause an increased threshold. At low currents, there is spontaneous emission in all directions. As the current is increased, the gain increases until the threshold for laser action is reached. An increase in the light output is observed, and a beam is emitted from either reflecting end.
Slide 3.
Now, in the next slide, we have a series, series of micro photographs taken with an image converter of both ends of a gallium arsenide laser as it passes through threshold going from left to right. On the very left-hand side, you see the laser below threshold, and the spontaneous emission appears as a light line on both ends, and it is fairly uniform, showing that the current distribution is fairly uniform. In the second set of pictures, you're just above threshold, and a stimulated emission appears as a single bright spot on both ends, showing that you actually have a filament extending down the length of the laser. This filament reaction is most often caused by inhomogeneities. Further above threshold, more filaments appear until eventually, in the pictures at the very right, the whole junction is essentially eliminated by the stimulated emission. The threshold condition for a junction laser can be obtained simply as shown in the next slide.
Slide 4.
Light intensity at any point varies exponentially with position in the laser. Now, the threshold condition is given in the second line. It's simply that the wave make a complete round trip of the cavity and suffer no net attenuation, including the losses at the ends. And in this equation here, R is the reflectivity of the ends, G sub T is the gain at threshold due to stimulated emission, and alpha is the loss, which is due to free carrier absorption and also to interband absorption in the inactive parts of the laser, and L is the cavity length. Now, we want to relate the gain at threshold to the current density going through the junction. Now, the gain for stimulated emission is proportional to the rate of stimulated emission, the gain at an energy E, and it is proportional to the population inversion, that is the number of delta N, the number of electrons in the upper state minus the number in the lower state. Now,
slide 4A.
Now, if we assume, for the sake of concreteness, that we are injecting into the P side of the junction, and there is good evidence that this is true, then the population inversion will simply be equal to the injected electron density, N sub I, since the lower state, if we assume we're at 0 degrees Kelvin, will be unoccupied. And it's important that we be at 0 degrees Kelvin for this assumption to be true. Now, then, the continuity equation requires that the injected electron density is proportional to the current density. Therefore, we have that the gain is proportional to the current, or G is equal to beta J. Now, then, we can rewrite the threshold condition in terms of the current, and that's shown in the next slide.
Slide 5.
We have that the threshold is given in terms of alpha and beta and the length of the laser, and beta is given in the second line. Now, the important quantities here are the thickness of the light emitting region and the quantum efficiency eta, and then the line width delta E, and of course the photon energy
E.
This is the index of refraction.
N.
Now, the only two quantities that are uncertain in this equation for the threshold are the thickness of the active region, which we take to be about 2 microns as a typical value, and the quantum efficiency, which we take equal to 1 as an ideal, as an ideal value, so that the ideal value of beta is about 0.14 centimeters per amp. Now, it now beta and alpha can be determined directly from experiment by several techniques. One method that has proved very effective uses the fact that the threshold current is proportional to 1 over the length of the laser, as you can see in the top line. What is done is the threshold for a series of lasers of several lengths are measured, and then the results are plotted as a function of 1 over L.
Slide 6.
The next slide shows an example of experimental data. As you can see, a good straight line is obtained, provided you have a good set of lasers. The slope of a line determines beta, and the intercept is equal to alpha over beta, where for very good lasers with carrier concentrations less than about 10 to the 18th per cubic centimeter, the experimental value of beta determined in this
way,
in this value, is within a factor of 2 of the calculated value shown, which we saw on the last slide. The value of alpha obtained experimentally is typically around 10 reciprocal centimeters, which for typical laser lengths has only a small effect on the value of the threshold current density, and it is also in good agreement with theory. Therefore, in the liquid helium temperature range, the threshold for gallium arsenide is very close to the ideal value. Now, what about the situation at higher temperatures? The threshold increases with temperature, as the earlier Dr. Ivey mentioned. This, of course, is an important stumbling block to the potential use and application of junction lasers.
Slide 7.
The qualitative explanation for the increase is quite simple and can be seen rather easily in the next slide, which is a plot of the energy versus density of states. The semiconductor is shown in the inverted state for photons of energy h nu in both diagrams. At the right, at 0 degrees Kelvin, there are sharply defined energies, the Fermi levels, between the occupied and the unoccupied states. The conduction band is filled up to the Fermi energy, and the valence band is empty down to its Fermi level. Thus, for the energy H nu, the upper states are all filled, and the lower states are all empty, so that there can be only emission, but no absorption of photons in the active region. In contrast, at the right, for finite temperatures, the electron and hole distributions are smeared out. Thus, some of the upper states are empty and the lower states filled, so that there can be absorption as well as emission in the active region. A higher current will be required to produce the same degree of inversion or the same gain, and hence the threshold current rises as we increase the temperature.
Slide 8.
The next slide shows some experimental data of threshold current density versus temperature for 2 gallium arsenide junction lasers. The numbers are the substrate electron concentrations for the junctions. At low temperatures, the threshold is constant, and at higher temperatures, it increases about T cubed. Now, this is in reasonable agreement with theoretical calculations. There is a discrepancy, however. The two diodes have about the same threshold at room temperature, but at lower temperatures, the heavier doped junction has a much higher threshold by more than an order of magnitude. On the simplest basis, one would expect that they would have just about the same threshold at low temperatures, except for a somewhat wider line width in the more heavily doped junction. It appears as if crystal imperfections, as you might expect, are more serious in the heavier doped crystal. The nature of these imperfections is not completely known at the present time. Now, this problem has been solved to some extent by the use of solution-grown junction lasers and also by heat treatment of diffuse lasers. So that presently thresholds of 30 to 40,000 amps per square centimeter, about a factor of 3 or 4 lower than in the slide here, are observed at room temperature. In principle, some further improvement can be obtained in this area. CW aberration has been observed up to 120 degrees Kelvin in gallium arsenide junction lasers. At room temperatures, it is necessary to use pulses of a few hundred nanoseconds duration or less, with repetition rates of less than about 100 kilopulses per second to avoid burning out the laser. In order to summarize the present state of the art, I would like to describe the construction and operation of gallium arsenide lasers in a heat sink mount made at IBM by J.C. Marinace.
Slide 9.
As shown in the next slide, the laser diode is mounted between two relatively large copper bars. The junction plane is parallel to the bars, which serve as electrical contacts to the N and P regions. An insulating spacer is provided, and the bars are made so that it is necessary to force them open to insert the laser. The laser is under a fair amount of pressure, and good thermal contact is thus provided.
Slide 10.
The next slide shows a photograph of the mount. In the picture at the right, you can see the laser diode right there.
Slide 11.
Now the next slide shows a plot of optical power output versus current density along the bottom of the slide and current along the top at 77 degrees K. These data were taken in an integrating sphere type apparatus, but because of the geometry of the mount, about 80 to 90% of the light comes out from one end. As you can see, the threshold is about 2/10 of an amp, and the differential quantum efficiency indicated there is 36%. The actual power efficiency in this in this region here is over 25%. The peak power of over 800 milliwatts in this diode is reached at about 2.5 amps. Now this slide is fairly old, and more recently, typical maximum power outputs for these lasers range between 1 and 2 watts, with the best values obtained thus far slightly over 3 watts. And an interesting point about this slide is that, as you can see, the current density for maximum power output is about 60,000 amps per square centimeter. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the room temperature thresholds are well below this, as low as 30,000 amps per square centimeter. However, the thermal conductivity of gallium arsenide decreases by a factor of 5 in going from 77 to room temperature, so that we are still a long way from CW operation at room temperature. In order to get the better heat dissipation necessary for continuous operation at high temperatures, the laser must be made long and narrow, very long and narrow in the junction plane, so that essentially a line heat source is approached. Now, Keyes has shown that a laser length to width ratio of about 500 is required for CW operation at room temperature. Now this, unfortunately, is beyond the present state of the art for junction lasers. At the present time, actual room temperature performance is for good lasers is about 30 watts of power in a 30 nanosecond pulse with 300 amps of current. Of course, higher powers can be obtained with the use of arrays.
Slide 12.
The next slide shows a 6x10 array of junction lasers made at IBM by Jim Crow. The size of this thing is, well, it's 80 mils wide by 25 mils high. Now, from a similar array of diodes, of 40 diodes, Crowe has observed a total emitted power from one end of the laser of the array of 360 watts at room temperature, of course in a pulsed mode of operation.
Slide 13.
Now returning to 77 degrees K CW operation, the next slide shows a typical far field pattern for one of these lasers. The film is somewhat saturated, so you actually tend to overestimate the angular divergence of the beam. But as you can see, the beam is emitted in an angle of about 15 degrees in the vertical plane by about 6 degrees in the horizontal plane, and the horizontal plane is the plane of the junction. It is apparent from the complexity of the pattern, the horizontal pattern is actually a result of the interference with the mount, but the vertical bar pattern is always observed in junction lasers. It is apparent from this that there are several modes present. Single mode operation would give a single vertical bar.
Slide 14.
The next slide gives some more direct evidence on this. It is a plot of the wavelength of the modes of a laser as a function of Kern. The strongest modes are indicated by the circles, and the very weak ones by the X's. And the size of the circles gives you some idea of the strength. There are several points of interest. First, only very close to threshold is single mode operation observed. Essentially, single mode. As I said, these X's are very weak modes. At higher currents, several strong modes are observed. Furthermore, the spacing in wavelength of these modes is as I think you can see if you look very carefully, is not equal, which means that they cannot all satisfy the simple axial mode Fabry-Perot condition that, you know, M lambda equals 2NL. Now we don't have a detailed explanation of these modes. They may be off-axis modes. However, Fenner at GE has observed that these several families or so-called off-axis modes appear in cleave diodes, but not in polished diodes. Therefore, it's easy to believe that they're associated with cleavage steps, although no direct correlation of them with cleavage steps has been made. In any case, the fact that we have several modes of the laser excited, and even in polished units, you also get several multi-mode operation far above threshold. It means that the laser output is not completely coherent, and we cannot get a diffraction limited beam with an optical system. In other words, what we have in practice is an extremely bright incoherent light source. All hope is not lost, however, for single mode output. It has been observed at several times threshold current in selected very small lasers at liquid helium temperature with power outputs in the tens of milliwatt range. But the current is several times threshold, and of course what we'd like to do is extend this to larger lasers and higher temperatures. Another point about the slide is the shift in wavelength of the predominant mode. This is caused by heating and is composed of two parts. First, a continuous shift of the individual modes due to a change of the index of refraction. And second, a jumping from one mode to the next caused by the energy gap change. Now, the p-n junction is a very convenient way of pumping a semiconductor laser. However, in many materials, for example, the large band gap 2,6 compounds, p-n junctions cannot be made. Recently, Weiser and Woods have discovered a new method for pumping a gallium arsenide laser, which preserves some of the attractive features of the p-n junction laser. The channels are generated by avalanche breakdown in a structure illustrated schematically in the next slide.
Slide 15.
The structure is a thin high resistivity, or pi, region sandwiched between two degenerately doped P regions. A voltage is applied across the device so that the field is sufficiently high in the central high resistivity region to cause across the gap ionization of electron hole pairs, or avalanche breakdown. The electrons are then accelerated into one of the degenerately doped P regions where the field is low, and they can thermalize and form a degenerate distribution, and laser action can be observed. Now, Weiser's real structure is somewhat more complex than I've indicated here. It actually contains two high resistivity regions. The power efficiency that he's observed is about a factor of 10 below p-n junction lasers, because the because the applied voltage in order to sustain the avalanching is about an order of magnitude higher than the photon energy. But this does not appear to be a fundamental limitation. Recently, Crowder, Woodhead, and Wagner have made similar structures in zinc telluride, which give efficient incoherent emission at 77 degrees at 5,400 angstroms, but no laser action has been observed. The field of semiconductor lasers is continuing to develop rapidly. At this stage, it is difficult to say what applications will be important. The possibility of making an optical computer using injection laser devices, and it has been found that the devices necessary to do optically coupled logic can be made. It is difficult to believe that this approach would ever displace transistors, but it may have some impact in parts of the computer if better devices can be made and if the coupling problem can be solved. The effects are interesting and may provide a basis for more useful devices. I shall mention just a couple of devices. An optical interaction between lasers, which can be used to generate logical negation, which is sufficient to actually do logic, is the quenching or turning off of one laser by another. Can I have the next slide?
Slide 16.
The input radiation of a quenching laser is passed through the active region of a second laser in a direction different from the resonant direction of the second laser, in this case on the left in a perpendicular direction. The radiation from this quenching laser is amplified in the active region of the second laser, and the power gain is subtracted from the output of the second laser. If the second laser is fairly close to threshold, the gain can be reduced sufficiently to turn it off. Now, Fowler has observed the quenching of one gallium arsenide laser by another using this configuration shown on the left. The two lasers are mounted as closely as possible to each other on the same transistor header. Nevertheless, the coupling is rather inefficient, since most of the light from the quenching laser is lost because of its finite beam angle, and also because of scattering at the solid surfaces of the quenched laser. A much more efficient system of quenching of gallium arsenide lasers, in which both lasers are made in a single block of material, has been made by Kelly. With the use of silicon dioxide masking techniques, two electrically isolated junctions are made in a single block, as shown on the right-hand part of the slide. All of the sides perpendicular to the junctions are cleaved, but parts of two of them are etched, so that we get the quenching laser lasing in this direction and the quenched laser here lasing out this way. The quenched laser is actually inside the cavity of the quenching laser, and the by using this technique, Kelly observed about an order of magnitude higher coupling than Farmer obtained.
Slide 17.
The next slide shows an injection laser structure that can be operated in an optically bistable mode. That is, two stable optical states for one electrical state. The laser is divided into two parts by a channel etched in the P side of the junction. The current is put through one contact, say the number one contact, so that the unit is just below threshold. The second part of the laser is inactive. Now, actually, the cavity is the whole length of a laser between the reflecting ends. Now, if we're biased just below threshold and we send an additional pulse of current in, or a light pulse, then the laser will stay on and remain on after the pulse is turned off. The device can also be switched off with either a negative electrical pulse or, in principle, by the quenching scheme, which we saw in the last slide. The explanation for this effect is thought to be that the inactive region acts as a saturable absorber, which can give two stable states to the laser under the proper conditions. That's off the slide, please.
Slide 18.
The ease of high-frequency modulation makes a gallium arsenide injection laser attractive from a communications and radar standpoint. In most communications systems, the laser will be operated well above threshold. Therefore, as we have seen, the output will be multimode and heterodyne detection techniques cannot be used. The major advantage of the laser over an incoherent light-emitting source are its directionality and its high external quantum efficiency, which can give a high overall efficiency into an optical system. The frequency response is also better. The major disadvantage is, of course, that the laser must be refrigerated in order to take advantage of its frequency response. A big problem common to all terrestrial optical communication over long distances is atmospheric attenuation. Several optical links which use gallium arsenide injection lasers as transmitters have been constructed. Scheele and co-workers have demonstrated one of them to be capable of transmitting 24 voice channels over a distance of 13 kilometers. In summary, at the present time, we have the gallium arsenide laser, an easily modulated, simple, efficient, infrared but incoherent light source, which puts out of the order of 1 to 2 watts of optical power at 77 degrees K. The main properties which require improvement are its coherence properties and also its room temperature operation. The areas of attack are crystal perfection and improved structure and packaging.
Slide 19.
We have time for one or two questions this time, if there are any. And again, I'd like to ask that you please give your name and affiliation clearly.
Dr. Nathan, my name is Stoliar from Sperry Rand. You showed a slide of a 6x10 array, I believe.
Yes.
Were the junctions, were they multiple junctions, or were they mechanically assembled? Was that in the vertical direction?
In the vertical direction, they were the contacts were plated with indium, and they were just stuck together.
Any other questions?
Green of the Sound Lab. In your P pi P arrangement, is the pi part, was that the type that Weezer doped with manganese?
Yes.
You have been watching and listening a slide tape talk state-of-the-art in gallium arsenide lasers, originally presented by Dr. Marshall I. Nathan, IBM Research Laboratories, Yorktown Heights, New York, at the IEEE Basic Sciences Committee Seminar, May 11, 1966, at the Stevens Institute of Technology, Hoboken, New Jersey. Thank you.